Welcome to the Underwater Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of underwater portrait photography, cinematography, and everything in between. With me, your host, Brett Stanley. Welcome back to the Underwater Podcast. And this week, we're learning how to let go of our work with Steve Richard. Steve has an amazing take on underwater photography. His approach is quite unique and results in a beautiful painterly feel to his images. We chat about building a personal dogma to help find your artistic voice and how people can approach work in very different ways. Oh, and Steve is a demon with a delete button. All right, let's dive in. Or in Steve's case, just stay dry. Steve, welcome to the Underwater Podcast.
Oh, thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. And now you're in Eastern Canada. Where exactly are you?
So I'm in a city called Halifax. It's in Nova Scotia. So it is on the East Coast. And it's basically northeast of Maine for anybody in the U.S. And basically quite far west of the U.K.
Right.
Kind of a wet journey to get here if you don't have a plane.
Yeah. Is it actually part of Canada or is it a...
Yeah, it's a province of Canada.
Yeah.
So it's not quite, there's one more province that's north and further east is Newfoundland, but Nova Scotia is basically right on the coast. So our coastline is the Atlantic Ocean.
Right. So you're kind of out in the sticks a little bit. I mean...
It depends. Yeah. So I live in a city that's, you know, it's called Metro. There's three cities combined, maybe 450,000 people, which is, you know, in some places that's a town.
Right.
And so it's kind of a smaller, it's not for us, it's not the sticks, but it certainly is a smaller lifestyle, if you wish.
Yeah.
You know, much smaller than Toronto, but certainly much bigger than other, you know, other cities.
Right.
So, I think you're from, is it New Zealand?
Well, originally I'm from Australia, so I grew up in Sydney.
Australia, yeah. Sorry.
Is that where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in the next province over called New Brunswick, which is a bit smaller as far as population. But I've lived in Nova Scotia, you know, a few times. And I actually lived in the Caribbean for almost 6 years too. I lived in the Bahamas for a while.
Oh, wow. That's kind of the opposite, I guess.
It certainly is. Many, many ways. Many ways, yeah.
So how did you find yourself in the Bahamas?
Initially it was wonderful, mostly because of the weather was incredible and the access to just incredible, clear, beautiful water. You know, I mean, I did my scuba training in New Brunswick. I think we did our open water testing in January in this body of water called the Bay of Fundy. And you know, I didn't have a dry suit. I had a 10 mil wetsuit and I thought I was going to die, you know. And so it was interesting the first time I dove in the Bahamas, I just couldn't believe that I could see past my, you know, my elbow. And that I wasn't freezing to death.
Yeah.
It was amazing for underwater photography without question. It was just such a change. And for many things, it was a change, but it is very much the island life. And I don't know at the end of the day whether I'm an island life type of person. So
yeah,
I found it a bit difficult after a while. Yeah,
it is a very different lifestyle and different pace of life, I think. And I think for me, like I like it in small doses. I think I don't think I could do it permanently.
Yeah, it once again, ups and downs. And it's not like I have a negative experience. It's just, you know, after a while, it really wasn't for me. And I guess the other thing is I'm a really wimp when it comes to I hate being cold and I hate being hot.
Right.
So yeah, it's definitely hot.
So let's take it back a little bit. I think I've jumped a gun a little bit taking you to the Bahamas, but how did you get into underwater photography? Was it something that you had planned? Was it something you thought of as a younger person or was it?
Wow. Well, I was living in New Brunswick and I think I started experimenting a little bit in pools and with a housing. It was a Ikelite housing for DSLR, or not DSLR, SLR, of course. This is way back.
So still in film days.
Still in the film days. And maybe to step back a bit. So yeah, I've been, you know, I'm what you call old, and I started shooting around 1973. So I've been in the game a little bit of time, but I started in pools with an Ikelite housing, a used Ikelite housing that I bought, and was really just couldn't get over how maybe ethereal everything seemed underwater, how different everything seemed. And that's what sparked me to do my diving certification. So I signed up and, you know, and started buying used gear and you know, did the classes and did the training and the pool training and did all my, you know, open water certifications.
Yeah.
And then realized, you know, it, certainly where I lived at the time, you know, probably the worst environment ever to do underwater photography, you know.
Because it's freezing there, right? Like in the winter.
So we dove in the ocean. So it never really, I don't know if you, do you want to talk in centigrade or in Fahrenheit?
Whatever you're comfortable with. We have people all over the world.
Okay. So usually, you know, the temperatures are not much above 0 centigrade and, you know, 5 or 7 degrees. So it's, you know, it's a salt water. So it doesn't get, it, you know, it doesn't ice over, but it's cold.
Yeah.
So you're usually wearing a 10 mil wetsuit or a dry suit. And even in the summer where you're diving in the ocean, it's still fairly cold there. And once again, being a wimp, I couldn't afford a dry suit at the time. So I just had, I had a 10 mil wetsuit that was not quite my exact size. So there was always these little pockets of freezing cold water sneaking in.
The dribble down the back of the neck and
under the arms. And but you know, and you've got the whole head, you know, the head trout on that's squeezing your face to death. Yeah. And so it's not a really pleasant experience as far as comfort. But what was really annoying was the visibility is not great, you know, at the best of times.
Right.
So, you know, you're it's really a difficult, challenging environment to photograph in. And I like anybody who can produce decent underwater photos in that environment, you know, wow, kudos to them. That's fantastic. It was mostly beyond my capability.
And what were you shooting? Had you started down the fine art kind of route, or were you like dive photography?
Yeah, it was fine art, but I hadn't moved to fine art underwater at that point. I was still way too early in the learning curve.
Yeah.
You know, so some of the pool stuff I was starting to experiment with, yes, and figuring that. But it really wasn't until I moved to the Bahamas and then experienced this, you know, incredible change in water. And also in the Bahamas, where I lived, I had access to a pool every day, you know, nice and well-maintained, so really clear water, and could do quite a bit of experimenting and learning. Yeah.
And would that pool was in Nova Scotia or in the Bahamas?
No, in the Bahamas, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So basically, you know, I didn't do a lot of underwater photography, or I was not successful underwater photography in Canada. And I think it was 1992, maybe, 91, 92, that I moved to the Bahamas. And that's when I really started, you know, a much better journey towards fine art underwater stuff.
So what took you to the Bahamas? Was it a photography decision or was it something
there's
else?
There's many decisions, but it was just wanting, for the most part, my wife and I wanted to just try living in a warmer place.
So that was a lifestyle choice.
Yeah, it was a lifestyle choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereabouts did you end up? Were you in Nassau?
We were in Nassau, yeah. And ironically enough, we lived on Paradise Island, you know. So, you know, which is much different now than it was back then, but it was quite a pleasant place to live for the most part, you know.
And so then how did you end up kind of using that crystal clear water that's down there? Well, I mean, it's a bit of a playground really, isn't it?
It was. In fact, so I ended up moving from, so I had the Ikelite housings and I also had an Iconus 5, which is you know, a rangefinder film camera.
Yeah.
Nikon. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever used one, but
I haven't used one, but I've seen them and they're basically, you know, there's no, it is the housing, the whole camera is waterproof.
Yeah. Yeah. It's underwater. It's all, you know, the lenses are attached with O-rings and it's a totally unique experience to use. Of course, you know, you got 36 frames and then you have to come back up and reload. And
it's the underwater equivalent of the old point and shoot camera where you didn't even really have a viewfinder.
No, that's right. Well, in fact, yeah, there was all kinds of ways that you would just, you know, set up your view that you could figure out, you know, what was in your frame and not. And of course, it was a rangefinder, so you'd even for your focus, you'd start, you basically trial and error, but you would learn, you know, what the distance settings meant, and you try to judge, you know, what was going to be in focus and not in focus. And, right. And I had underwater strobes as well that, you know, that would sync off the camera. So, but it was certainly laborious and a great deal of work to try to capture anything that was unique and different.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah. So what were you shooting? What sort of subjects were you shooting?
Well, I did a lot of just dive photography, but, you know, coral reef, fish, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of, I loved kind of bodies in motion. So any opportunity I had, I would work with models or dancers and, you know, we'd bring cloth in the water and mostly just experiment, and both in the pool and also in the ocean, and mostly failures. But one thing I figured out is this is something I just loved. I loved the look, this very ethereal, this very surrealistic beauty of bodies in motion underwater.
Yeah.
And so that got me hooked. That was where I figured, you know, hey, I'm going to be this commercial photographer, but I want to be known to be this kind of underwater art photographer. And it's probably, you know, you're talking 1994. Ish, 95, yeah. Maybe, yeah.
And so were you a working photographer at this point already?
I had a couple of gigs, but one of them was as a commercial photographer, so
right.
Doing ad photography. I wasn't in the wedding portrait business, but you know, like advertising and, you know,
more commercial.
Probably some commercial corporate stuff.
And was there a lot of that happening in Nassau at that time?
Not a great deal. Enough. You know, there was a couple of wonderful companies that I became, the on the top of the list for them. And so that was enough to keep me at least moving along with the other things I had on the go.
Right.
But it certainly wasn't the center of commercial photography in the world by no means.
But maybe in the Bahamas it was.
Yeah, you're right. You know, and I have to admit, I had some wonderful, unique opportunities because you also had to, as you know kind of a little about many things instead of a lot about a few things. So you'd end up, you know, having the opportunity to shoot out of helicopters and some underwater,
right.
You know, just unique experiences. So I was quite happy to be involved with that. And then always, you know, on the side, trying to develop this, you know, as we all do as photographers, you know, have this kind of artist peeking through.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of the genesis for me of trying to develop kind of a unique voice, something that I could create work that was totally for me and made me happy.
And how did you go? Did it come easily to you, this voice, or was it something that took a while?
Well, I don't think it's come to me yet, so I don't think it's easy. And it's funny. I tell this story. It was kind of ruined for me. I was living in the Bahamas and having this wonderful experience working underwater and great opportunities. And I thought the work was probably coming along, not too bad. And it wasn't until I was actually in Toronto and doing a visit, and I was at this huge bookstore that's no longer there. And I always visited the photography section, and sitting right in front shelf, you know, was the cover of this book looking at me. And I couldn't believe the image I was looking at. It just blew my mind. And of course it was a book, Howard Schatz's first book called Water Dance. And I picked this up and looked at it and I nearly passed out. I just went, this is his body of work at that time was beyond my imagination of where I could even be,
yeah.
Let alone what I was doing.
Yeah.
So it was, in a way, a bit devastating.
Bit of a gut punch.
A gut punch with a 2x4 shot out of a cannon.
In a bookstore.
In a bookstore. So, of course, I bought the book and celebrated it. I didn't resent it. I just thought, wow, this is incredible.
Yeah.
How could I possibly get there? But maybe more important is that I didn't want to copy this. I didn't want to just go in and say, oh, well, maybe with, you know, 1,000 years of practice, I could get to this point. Mm-hmm. It was, how can I... Can I steer a little different path and try to find a different voice? So I did. I did, you know, spend a bit more time searching and playing with underwater stuff And until I found another book, I think it was 1998, by this guy called Howard Schatz. and I think this was, I don't know if it was Pool Light or, it was the second book, which I always find funny because I love it when photographers raise the bar, but when they raise the bar on their own work, it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
And at that point, I just went, okay, this is just starting to become insane now. You know, this work is so far beyond my comprehension. Maybe I should try to find another place to look. And so I kept farting around with a lot of fine art but I walked away from the water. And the only diving I did and the only photography I did was back to kind of reef fish, you know, and it was more just for my own entertainment. But I did walk away from that as being a fine art approach, so, except for one day. And yeah. I think you've probably been to the Bahamas. Have you? You shot in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
So you know how clear and calm the water is.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a little CNC sailboat at the time for a few years down there, a 26 foot that I'd go out on. And it was one day that I was diving and shooting some, you know, coral reef stuff. And I climbed up in the boat, and it was one of those days that the water was perfectly flat, an absolute crap day for sailing, of course, because there's no wind.
Yeah.
But you know, the boat's anchored not too far off of a little island, and it looked like it was hovering over the sand. It was it's one of those days.
Yeah.
But I looked down, and there was a bunch of the fish that I was shooting through the surface of the water, and I went, oh my gosh, this is incredible. This is like the most beautiful ethereal moment. And I took some pictures from the surface, you know, through the water, and the little light bulb went on and said, wait a minute, how can you do this so it's not too abstract, but still has that beauty? And that's what started the journey for me into this body of work that became known as Obscuro. In fact, I released a book in 2015 with this body of work.
But yeah. I mean, it's such a different perspective. It's not something you think of when you think of underwater photography, that the camera is directly above the water shooting through. It's like you say, it's a very rare scene because the water is usually too choppy to, you know, it's too
moving to too see
much.
It. Yeah. Well, it looks, and probably, you know, without access to such beautiful water like the Bahamas, I might not have ever seen the idea.
No.
The irony is, you know, I experimented a little bit with that, but it wasn't until, oh my gosh, I think I had moved back to Canada already. And I think around 2003, I was shooting a commercial job back in the Bahamas, but I was living in Canada. And we're at a complex that had a pool, and we had a few extra days. And a makeup artist at the time, a very good friend of mine, was taking pictures of her friend in the pool, but she was doing the same thing, shooting through the surface. And it was a little digital point and shoot. And she came up and said, oh, you know, this is really cool. And I said, yeah, I know it's really cool. I've been experimenting with a long time, but I hadn't thought about it. And she showed me the picture. I went, you know, let's, do you mind if we shoot for the next couple of days? And we literally, I talked to the owner of, you know, putting some support and staging over the pool so we could mount the camera up above. And I started doing some really serious testing with the technique. And that really got the ball rolling and continued on back in Canada, where I didn't have that much access to pools, but every chance I could, I would experiment with this technique.
And do you, when you first saw it with that pool setup, could you see how it could be done better and how it could work, how your vision could come to life?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and so there was a couple of things. So in 2003, I think I had, I can't remember what camera, I bought into digital fairly early on with a $12,000 Kodak DCS 760, which was a 6 megapixel, you know, a Nikon F5 body built on a Kodak, you know. So it was at the time incredible, but you know, in today's standards, I think, you know, probably someone's watch has more power.
Yeah, totally.
But I think the testing we might have done with a Nikon D2X or something, I can't remember at the time. So it had some pretty serious limitations on, you know, how much light you needed, in the water, and there was a great deal of noise, and so the experimenting did have some technical hurdles that were tough, but there was also some other hurdles, and I'm going to have to maybe take a sidestep, but this will maybe give you a bit more perspective on my approach to photography. But
yeah,
I'm not really interested in capturing images, and meaning I never really had much interest on the fine art side to jump in the water and document fish or to document dancers. It was always about creating some illusion, creating some scene, telling a story.
Right.
And so having absolute control was really important. And one of the things I learned early on is that when you're trying to shoot someone underwater, that becomes really difficult because they don't have much control. And to repeat a move, you know, until you have it perfect, which is typically what I do, you know, so if I'm shooting dancers or whatever I'm shooting, you know, we might take 40 to 400 shots of the same kind of thing until I tune it perfectly, until
right.
it's exactly right. And that becomes just brutal with someone underwater.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And as you know, especially if they're floating up and down. So even shooting through the surface, this became extremely difficult.
Yeah.
So the two things I learned after a bunch of experimenting and failures was that I would have to have some place I could go to every day and fail day after day after day.
Right.
That was the big realization for me, that just having access to a pool every now and then and going, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to go shoot for 2 or 3 hours. This was literally, you know, I'm going to need thousands of hours.
Right. And is that because that's your workflow? That's how you like to refine it so much?
Yeah. So I exactly. Well, I'm not very, I wouldn't make a very good sports photographer. Like the moment's already happened before I go, hey, that
right.
could be good. But I call it a personal, your personal dogma. I think all artists have to establish this thing called a personal dogma, or, you know, a set of rules that really only make sense to them. They're not
yeah.
really rules. There's no laws of physics that guide them. They're just rules. And I think for me, that's really important. And one of the things that's really important to me is that I don't do any post-production, or I do very minimal, you know, I do blemish kind of removal, but I don't do any composite work. I don't, if I can't get it in camera, I won't do the photograph. And that's just batshit crazy. And I understand it's insane. But it's not that I disagree with it. It's just, this is my dogma.
I totally get it. I have recently become obsessed with capturing stuff in camera underwater. And it's that the challenge and the reward to me is far outweighs anything else.
Well, I agree 100%. But don't get me wrong, anybody listening, it's not that I think everybody should do that. It's just what's right for me.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And personally for me, it's a personal challenge. It's for me, it's something like, oh, okay.
Can I do this?
Exactly. Yeah. The technical hurdles that you have to get over to make it work, that is what gives me joy. Whereas, you know, even compositing in Photoshop and getting something right in Photoshop still gives me joy. It's just a different challenge.
It's a totally different approach, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so for me, it's a bit different. Doing it in camera makes me think very much about the story and how I'm creating the moment.
Right.
So it's almost like sculpting in a way, where you just do it bit by bit and it develops in front of you, but it needs to be an iterative process. So I always find it, you know, interesting how some people really can just go out and have their models or their actors or whoever they're working with just move and they capture these moments and that's their approach. They try to find what they're looking for there. And for me,
yeah.
it's totally different. It's really more like sculpting and trying to create, ironically enough, a moment that looks like it was captured.
Right. Yeah. So for you, the process of capturing it in camera almost forces you to be in the moment a little bit more and to find the storyline that's in there.
Well, yeah, absolutely right, with a little tiny tweak. So I call this personal dogma, and I have a whole list. And what, you know, one is getting it in camera, but there's other things like perfect body line. You know, if the body doesn't really have this perfect dance line, I won't accept the image.
Right.
If you know, I really like anonymity, except ironically enough for this new series I'm working on, but I really like this sense of that the body is telling the story and not the emotions of the face.
Yeah.
So all of these things in a way set the stage. And so I usually have the stage set, you know, I kind of know what the mood of the story is and a little bit of what I'm trying to tell. But other than that, no, then I need to be working with the model, the dancer, to start the sculpture, to begin right. this process.
Yeah.
And you're right. From there, it is in the moment. But you have to be prepared to just have that repeatability. And as you know, underwater is just holy shit crazy to try to do that.
Yeah. Especially if you're dealing with, you know, like a swimming pool, which is probably about 5 or 6 feet deep. It's hard to get the same depth every time. It's hard to be in the same spot every time.
And your model can't stay. It's just not enough depth to get the model down so they're not just popping right up to the surface again.
Yeah. So how did you solve those issues?
Well, so because I'm a lazy arse, I don't like, ironically enough, I loved shooting through the surface of the water, but one of the reasons is I got to sit on my apple box in my comfortable air-conditioned studio.
Yeah.
And I never got, in fact, all the pools I had, I only got in once to look for a leak.
Oh.
And, so for me, the camera was, in my case, when we finally started shooting this series in a studio that was a custom-built studio. So we had literally built a studio in Halifax that had a little over 18 foot ceilings, and the camera was mounted up into the ceiling, and it was all at this time I have been for a long time using phase one camera back, so this is medium format,
right?
So it's tethered, you know, to computers, and the camera's mounted 18 feet up in the air pointing down at the pool. So now the problem is not me moving around anymore, because that's taken care of. So I'm always anchored. So the problem just becomes the water surface has to be perfectly flat and the model can't be coming up to the surface.
And so is this an actual, so you've built a swimming pool inside your studio or?
Three, in fact. So the first year that we started, 2012, I think it was, that we started, then the studio was complete. We built a pool using, you know, rubber pond liner and plywood and 2x4s.
Oh, okay. So you've built like an above ground pool your studio floor.
Yep. And a major learning curve. So basically the process for me was having the model sink very close to the bottom of the pool and try not to flow it up. And I would capture an image, but at least I could sculpt. I could literally give directions, say, next time you go down, do the exact same thing, except rotate your wrist a bit more, turn your head this way, blah, blah, blah. So it became back into my personal dogma. I could do everything that I normally do out of the water, even when I'm working with dancers, or my last book was all about aerialists. And the same process was, you know, with this incredibly talented group of people who are no longer were allowed to perform, but had to look like they were performing, but have me creating the illusion exactly of what I wanted.
I mean, that's what I love about your work is that it looks like everything's in motion. It looks like it's not a static image. And what blew me away was when I found out that it was underwater and you were shooting it from above was, how is there not ripples all across the surface of this? How is there not distortions?
Well, so this was the learning curve that was really steep.
Right.
So technically, you know, the problems you can figure out, you know, camera, I understand. But I learned fairly early on that when you put someone into 19 or 20 degree water and expect them not to move for 3 hours, it doesn't work very well.
No, people get caught.
They get really pissed at you.
Yeah.
So basically a couple of things that I had to learn was how to heat up fairly large bodies of water, which then I figured out grew bacteria and pumped thousands of percent of humidity into my building, which wasn't designed for it.
Right.
So you start to figure out, you know, okay, is it chlorine? Is it, how do you manage these problems? How do you vent that much humidity? How do you heat the water? So there was a bunch of technical things that at least the school of YouTube can answer for you. And luckily I had a friend who was at one time used to service pools and had some great advice on how to change, you know, the pH and keep the water a certain color and you know, just wonderful, wonderful advice from very supportive people that helped me maintain the technical aspect. Yeah. But the aspect of trying to figure out how a model could sink and why some models could sink and why other models couldn't, and then the ripples became really tough. And so we would do really crazy stuff, you know, like if we had a bit of cloth in the pool, we might put a weight under the cloth, and that would give the model the ability to go and just hang on to that for a second and then release, and we could grab the shot. Or we would tie for example, there's a shot that's a ballet dancer and her pointe shoes. So we mounted what looked like a floor to the side of the pool and put it on a bit of an angle. And I wanted to have this ballet dancer on point in the pool.
Yeah.
But of course, yeah, kind of weird. The perspective, of course, is that she's not actually standing up. She's laying down in a way. So we just bolted the pointe shoes to the fake floor.
Oh.
And that way, her feet would stay anchored. And of course, she'd have to come up and breathe. But now when she went down, it took a lot of core strength, but it could look like she was standing, even though she was sideways. So that was part one of the illusions, you know. And, yeah. And I just have 100 illusions and tricks that we used to do to make it look, well, like it wasn't underwater.
Yeah. So how deep is this pool that they're in?
So the one that was most successful was one we purchased from California. It was a portable pool. It literally had a couple of acrylic windows that we could light through. So I didn't have to use underwater strobes. So I could use fairly powerful, 2,000 watt second heads. And I'm very much into very soft light. So ironically enough, soft semi-directional light. So I use a great deal of diffusion, usually three layers of diffusion. So in this case, I could actually put some of the diffusion in the water. And so all the flagging and reflectors were, just hundreds of C-stands, not hundreds, tens of C-stands, with plastic flags and reflectors in the pool to do all the, the manipulating of the light that I like to do.
And your lighting is, now that you kind of explain it, it kind of makes sense to me because it's very directional. It's very side lit for the most part.
For me, side light's very important. In fact, I'm also a cinematographer and I struggle for a stand because this is my original thought. But one of the things he talked about lighting, and I'll never forget, is he said, backlight good, front light bad. And I think that's all you need to remember when it comes to fine art. Front light bad, backlight good. And that's it. And so for me, I always use, if front light basically lights up the subject and it's a really good way to document something, but side light or backlight's a great way to tell your story and let light become one of the actors.
I think the other thing as well is that it gives such a painterly look to it as well. I'm terrible with painters. I'm terrible with names of painters and styles, but the look that you've got is very, is it Rembrandt-y?
It's more Caravaggio, right. My pronunciation's shit of that, but it's so an Italian painter I don't really admire his subject matter, but his painting style is amazing. And with obviously Rembrandt is influential, but I think probably if I base most of my work as Caravaggio, which is use a great deal of the darkness. So for me, that's a big influence. In fact, for me, ironically enough, painters are my largest influence, more so than photographers.
Right. I mean, it does show through in your work. It does have that painterly look. And I think even the way the water has diffused some of the light hitting the camera has given that kind of soft hue to it.
Yes, you're right. Well, and I think most of us that do work underwater, that's what you realize is that this is something you can't really achieve, or maybe you can. I certainly can't because my dogma wouldn't allow me to do it.
Right.
But you can't achieve outside of the water. And, a number of people have asked, well, why do you go all this trouble, with pools and humidity and trying, nearly drowning your models and trying to figure out how to keep everybody underwater, and then you don't want it to look like it's underwater. And it's like, yeah, but I want it to look like there's no gravity, and I want to look like it's this soft, and there's no way the cloth underwater is never would do that in the air.
No, you know, and I think that also reinforces that painterly thing where, you know, as a painting, you can do whatever you want. You can make things do what they want. But if you're shooting this sort of series without water, there, short of having some sort of wind machine, this fabric is never going to make these kind of shapes.
No, and not at all. Well, it's, I spent a great deal of time shooting fabric in the air and with fans, and all, as you noticed, that all the illusions to show motion when there isn't any. But it won't look like this, or at least not in my experience.
Yeah. So how do you find and train the models that you work with? Are they people that have had underwater experience before, or is there a transition where they're learning how to do this?
Yes, both. Most people contact me, and of course, when people start showing images of this series, I started to have a lot of people contact me wanting to become part of it. And ironically enough, most of the people I shot with for underwater were people I've worked with before, so they understood my whole process. That, you know, number one, we might work for 3 hours and not get a single image.
Yeah.
And so we have to come back another day, which is you know, always kind of one of the things I'm quite adamant about, that where, you know, I might shoot for the whole day and I'm just looking for one image. If we get two, that's incredible, but I'm looking for one.
Right.
And we may not get it. We might just get an idea. So that's kind of the first thing. And then, to, you know, I like to work with people that know that I can spend, you know, 200 shots on just getting a hand right. And so that's really mandatory, that I'm working with people that understand that and are willing to kind of go through that process. So they're not going to be, you know, I don't know any other way to say it, but more like the fashion kind of shoot where the flash goes off and the model just changes the pose.
Yeah.
You know, that is so far away from what I do that it would be impossible for me to create anything that way.
And again, I think going back to that painting thing, you're kind of treating them like a painter's model, where they have to hold that pose until you've created that image, rather than changing and giving you variety, you're after that specific thing.
I think it's right. I think that's the difference of looking at photography from the perspective of an artist. And I had given this a great deal of thought. And at one point, I remember being in the Tate Gallery in the Tate Britain in the UK, and looking at one of my favorite paintings, which is Hope by Frederick Watts. And looking at this going, you know, the thing I just realized is every single brushstroke and every bit of color, every dab was put on this thing with intent.
Yeah.
And I said, how funny is it that most of us as photographers, there's not very much intent other than we've intended to push the button and point the camera.
Yeah.
And so I found that as a, you know, this was quite a while ago, many years ago, but that entered my head and said, I'm going to start doing everything with intent. I'm going to decide on everything.
Right.
Every single thing, unless it's totally out of my control. And I think, by the way, when you talk about why it's important to do things in camera, it also reinforces that intent. No decisions are made unless I intend them to be that way. So there's no chance. Yeah.
So for me, your process is the exact opposite of mine, where I am more like probably a Jackson Pollock, I think, where I just throw a whole bunch of shit against the canvas and see what sticks. And that is just how it works for me. I'm better at being reactionary to what happens in the moment and seeing and letting the moment drive the image, as opposed to the other way around. Whereas for you, I think couldn't do it
that way. It would totally go against my dogma. But I don't disagree with your way. I just disagree with it for me. That's all.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah.
And it's interesting how every artist has a different approach to it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And actually, a very good friend of mine, Renee Robbins, is a really good photographer, a young photographer. And we joke that, you know, I'll spend 3 days shooting an image and 3 seconds in post, you know, and I think she probably spends, you know, 20 to 30 minutes shooting the image and, you know, 300 hours in post.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're both after the same thing, right? We're both after creating this unique piece of art that's our own story and our own moment. And so that's what I find really funny, that we're both after the exact same thing. We just have radically different ways of doing it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's one of those times where the adage of it's, you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey, isn't really true. I think it's the journey informs the destination.
I think you're right. That's a good way to put it. I think you're 100% right. Yeah.
And part of doing these interviews for me is hearing the different journeys that people have to get that final image where, you know, when I first saw your work, and to be honest, it was Renee that put me onto it, and she said it was underwater. And in my mind, I had a whole different way of doing it than what you've described. And the way you, when we first spoke and you started describing how you did this, it blew my mind because it was not the way that I would have ever done it myself, but it's just come out so beautifully.
I don't know how to do it any other way than that approach, to be honest. I guess I think back and laugh at some of these shots took days, you know. Thankfully, I'm lucky to have models that will put up with that abuse of me just doing it over and over and over again. And they're just so dedicated at creating something unique and powerful that they'll come back in and just continue doing this.
Yeah.
And it allows me to work the way I do, but only by the charity of others. You know, like there's, you know, without that, then there's no way I could move forward with this.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And so what happens next? Now, once you've taken the shot and you've done the whatever post-processing you're doing, is there a financial side to this? Is this a revenue stream?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I joke, and I don't joke, but I think... So I no longer, and haven't for a long time, I don't do any commercial photography whatsoever.
Right.
I totally look at what I do as an artist. I describe myself as an artist that just uses photography as the tools.
Yeah.
And so to be an artist, I think you have to have two things. I think you have to create work with intent. I think every brushstroke, you know, has to have intent. Whether it's intent, your intent is the approach, like you said, like you're Jackson Pollock, you're throwing stuff and seeing if it sticks. It's still intent. You're still choosing what to throw and where to throw it. And but the second thing I think is really important is you need to take a vow of poverty. And, and I mean that jokingly, but not jokingly, but I mean it that you can't look at creating art based on whether it sells or not. You have to create it based on what you want to do and how you want to do it, what you want to say and how you want your audience to feel. And if it sells, that's wonderful. And you have to be prepared that it doesn't, because this is a shit market. This is really tough.
Right.
And for me, luckily, I sell some books and I sell some prints and I teach some workshops and I get to speak at events. And after how many years I've been doing this, yeah, I can etch out a living at it. But it's not, you know, when I have an intern that's working for me and said, well, I really would like to do photography as art. And I just think, okay, let me know how you make out, because if you can bypass the 20 years of, you know, trying to find your voice, then let me know. I think that was one of the questions you asked earlier. Is, you know, to me, having a unique voice is really, really tough and really, really important for an artist.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's hard to know whether you've even got one. Like, it's hard to... to look at your own work and go, oh, I see the voice in there, you know. I've told this story before, but for me, I was struggling to find my voice for years and years and years, and it wasn't until I looked back at my work of those years that I realized that I had one all along. I just couldn't see it.
Right, which is true, so for me, that one of the things I usually ramble on about is to say having your own personal dogma is a good way to start finding your voice. Like, so if you look back at your work, you would start to find out what your dogmas are. You already have them. You just might not have them defined.
Yeah, yeah.
And that really helps moving forward to say, oh, yeah, no, it at least allows you not to go down the path that you know won't be fruitful. And for me, when I'm doing a photograph in a studio, you know, I shoot tethered. And once again, very much like a sculpture, but I, at the end of a shoot, even if I've taken 400 or 300 images, there's only two or three left on the screen. I delete and edit as we go. And if I create an image that I think is a little closer to what I want than any of the previous ones, I delete all the previous ones. And in fact, it's my favorite thing to do to a new intern is to be shooting and have them quite thrilled with what they're seeing on the screen and then go select, you know, the 50 images previous to image 51 and watch their face as I hit the delete button.
Oh my God. And so you're literally deleting. You're not just like unselecting and
oh no, they're gone. Why would I? So you have to remember, this is very iterative, and it's very much like, oh, this is closer now.
Right.
This is starting to tell the story I wanted to tell. So why would I even keep any of the others?
Yeah.
I'm certainly not, my dogma wouldn't allow me to take a hand from one image or a chin from another image and put them together.
Right.
So that's a no-brainer for me. I'm not going to comp anything. So if the current image I have up on board is better than, or at least in my mind, better than what I have, why would I keep any of it? I'm not going to use it. It's never going to see the light of day. I delete it.
See, that's so interesting. And I think the way that a photographer works in that way of do they delete or do they keep says a lot about their personality, I think. And, you know, in my side of things, I struggle to delete anything because I think, ooh, I'll come back to that.
Yeah. No, well, a true story. I don't think I have the numbers quite right, but everything I shot on, so I mostly shot slides. I shot medium format. I used for a long time an RZ, or if you're in the US, an RZ67 medium format camera, and mostly film. But I started using Phase One digital backs, you know, 15 years or 12 years ago, whatever it was. And now I actually use a Phase camera as well. But you know, up to a couple of years ago, I was still using the RZ. And so I had a lot of film, and I even had a lot of 35 millimeter film, a lot of slides. And a great deal was what I called my fine art, you know, right back from, gosh, you know, the 80s. And I remember I had this all in archive, and I had what I called outtakes, and I had what I called final images, you know. And the final images would still, out of a shoot, I might have, you know, 200 images from a shoot that I might have shot 600 images from. And I even kept most of the outtakes. So finally, you know, a few years before that, I had went in and literally destroyed all the outtakes. I put a light table up and looked and said, yeah, I don't know why I kept any of this. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that we were thinking about moving, and my wife, who I've been with a long, long time, is a great editor and certainly is probably knows my work better than I do. And she said, you know, all these old images, you probably should go through them because most of it's shit. And I thought, you're probably right, but I don't, you know, I really? And so at the new studio we built, I literally put some white plexi, some translucent plexiglass up and put some Kino lights underneath.
Yeah.
I made giant light tables and took my entire archive of old film. And, you know, I had no problem to destroy probably close to, I don't know, 50, 60,000 images.
That's crazy.
No problem.
Yeah.
I kept a few binders worth. And I just went, this was mostly just crap.
Yeah.
I have no idea why I kept this.
Is it because, do you think you kept it because it was a physical negative? That it was, you know, it's easy to kind of delete a file, but.
I think I kept it because I had some illusion in my head that it was good. And if I didn't look at it, maybe it was.
Right, yeah. Just knowing that it was there and you've got it kind of makes it.
So to, you know, to anybody who's ever heard me present, will get tired of this whole thing. But I have this mantra that I came up with a long time ago. It's really easy to take a picture of a beautiful thing. It's really difficult to take a beautiful picture. And what's even more difficult is realizing the difference between them. And I had binders and binders and binders with pictures of beautiful things, with very few beautiful pictures. And at the time, I didn't recognize the difference between the two. And most of the ones that were just pictures of beautiful things didn't have my intent whatsoever. There was no intent literally there. It was just me documenting things. And yeah, maybe the photograph was really done well, but I got to a point where I really wanted to be an artist. And if they didn't have my intent, if they didn't have my story, let alone my voice, why would I keep them?
Yeah. Yeah. Why would you own it if it doesn't seem like it's part of you?
Well, so other than maybe some tiny 1/1,000,000% of uniqueness I have in the lighting, the rest wasn't unique. It didn't have any story. So I just think, what do I need to get some, maybe post them someday and get some Facebook likes for what that's worth? Like, of course not. They're absolutely useless. And I think the irony is I had already started that approach in my shooting, my workflow. I do that every time I shoot. So it was really funny that I had kept this huge archive of film.
Yeah, because your workflow is to not keep the things that don't speak to you 100%.
Nope. And of course, you know, the commercial side, I used to keep on the commercial side the archive just in case you'd get a resale or you'd have the client that would come back and say, oh, you know, do you still have this? We'd like to access.
Yeah.
And even that I no longer keep now. So that's right. That's all been turfed.
Yeah. It's very Marie Kondo. You've let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So Steve, what's coming up for you? Are you still working on this series or are you?
No. So so the irony is that series, it's kind of like anybody who's ever owned a boat. You've got two of your best days is the day you buy it and the day you sell it. I think when we took the last image for this, and said, I think we're done. We have enough for a book, and we took the pool down for the last time. That was a wonderful day. I think I was getting tired of the process, and then I wanted to move on. In fact, I had already been shooting this project called Aerial, which is all to do with aerialists, and so it was. I think it was time. And of course, the aerial work's been done, and I've spent the last 2 years or more working on a new series that's really about group mythology. But it's really about current metaphors. In fact, it's me taking the piss out of a lot of things, but
right.
It's got a lot of humor and darkness in it. And maybe another day we can talk about that, but there's no water involved whatsoever. None. Zero.
Yeah. So how is your relationship with water and underwater photography? Have you moved on and did it serve its purpose?
I think I have. Yeah. So I thought about the pool again. And in fact, we sold the studio in December. So I'm now studio-less for the first time, probably in almost my adult life, that I don't have access to a studio other than rentals.
Yeah.
And at the time, I got rid of the pools, which was an acknowledgement that I'll probably never do that again.
Right.
I think I've already said what I needed to say with it. So yeah, I think you're right. And for me to squeeze into a wetsuit, probably kill myself going underwater is not going to happen.
Yeah, right. Well, especially in Halifax.
No, it's definitely. In fact, after I moved to the Bahamas, I never dove in cold water again.
Yeah, no. once you felt the warm water,
I remember the first time in the Caribbean, you know, jumping off the boat and going. What?
Yeah.
This is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, like I thought, why this isn't an order of magnitude. This is five orders of magnitude greater. You know, like why would you ever jump in this icy cold water when you're a wimp like I am? You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, I have friends who live in Halifax and are like professional mermaids and stuff. And they routinely go swimming in that water. And I just can't understand it.
It's tough.
Way tougher. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't, you know, to be honest, Brad, I don't even like to go outside.
Right.
I don't like bugs. I don't like the heat. I don't like the cold. I don't like the wind blowing my hair around. Like I'm really comfortable at you know, 20 degrees Celsius and
yeah.
A nice, comfortable studio. That's heaven for me.
This is good. But, I mean, at least you know that. At least you can, you know, you like to be.
Without question. I celebrate it. And once again, I admire people that are, you know, these kind of go out in the wilderness photographers and create this amazing work. And, you know, that's fantastic. But they have no threat of me ever invading their territory.
Yeah, true. Steve, this has been amazing. It's been really cool just to hear this journey, this story, and how you kind of worked out the logistics to create these images. It's beautiful.
Thanks, Brett. It's been my pleasure to speak to you about it. I'm happy to talk about this wonderful art form with anybody. So I appreciate you you searching me out.
Oh, of course. Yeah. No, as soon as I saw your images and kind of saw how they were being made, I had to share this with everyone. So I really appreciate it. Thanks,
no problem. And if you want, you can, there is, I think on my site, there's a little behind the scenes video of the Obscuro process.
You know, yeah, I will actually, I'll put that in the show notes for people so they can go and see the behind the scenes because it's really, tells how you've done
how it was done. Yeah. 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 I'm happy. You know, it's funny. I'm happy to give away the process. It's, you know, everything I've learned, I'm happy to, I'd love for someone to take it and push it further and further and further. Because I mean, that's how wonderful would that be? That's
that'd incredible. Be great. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. To see your baby taken and see it evolve.
It just won't be me. That's all.
Exactly. Yeah. Steve, thanks very much. It's been great to speak to you.
You as well. All the best. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And as always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe, review, and share. If you'd like to help with the production of these episodes, you can donate at theunderwaterpodcast.com. Any amount is welcome and really helps to keep the show going. If you'd like to connect with us or learn more about our guests, you can reach us at theunderwaterpodcast.com or on Instagram. We also have a Facebook group where you can discuss the episodes and even get your questions answered by our guests. There's a link to it in the show notes. You can learn more about my underwater photography workshops and mentoring at brettstanley.com or Brett S. Photo on Instagram. The Underwater Podcast is presented and produced by me, Brett Stanley, and our music is Neo by Oh Boy. Keep creating, everyone. I'll see you in the water.